It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, skill versus luck. We're up all night to get lucky. We're up all night to get lucky. In the late 90s, poker exploded because suddenly you could play it online. You could gamble on poker anywhere, anytime, for real money. And forget about going to Vegas. There were people making a living playing online poker at home in their pajamas. But then came Black Friday. April 15th, 2011, the day the federal government shut down the top three online poker gambling sites. They froze accounts, indicted executives, sent some of them to jail. And all those people who were making a living playing poker had to find something else to do. But here's the thing. Remember I said we're talking about skill versus luck? Well, the law that shut down internet gambling, it's called the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, that law has a loophole. It turns out it's not all internet gambling that's against the law. It's wagering on games that are subject to chance. And game designer, actually gaming legend, Jason Rohrer, took this loophole as a challenge.
I looked at the law and I read all the text of it. I was like, oh, so what if we could make a game that is not subject to chance that people would still feel like, hey, this is a game I might actually gamble on, right? Sort of threading through the loophole in the law perfectly at the same time making a game that was a compelling gambling game.
Okay, so what'd you come up with?
So I realized that, okay, so we can't have any random number generators. We can't have rolling dice. We can't have cards. We can't have a computer picking numbers out of a hat in any way, right?
Because that would be chance.
That would be chance. You can't do that. So you still need to have hidden information, right? You can't gamble and bet on something if both players know exactly what the state of the game is. So the hidden information has to come from the players. So my new game is called Cordial Minuet. There's a grid of numbers. It's a 6x6 grid. It looks pretty much like a bingo card with numbers from 1 to 36 kind of arranged in a pattern. Now, instead of bingo where, you know, you pull a ball out of a hopper and tell which number has been picked, the players are picking the numbers. One player is picking columns on the grid and the other is picking rows. And they're doing this in secret. And then those columns intersect after each turn, giving each player a number, one of the numbers from 1 to 36 that adds into their score. But as the columns get removed from the grid, there's more and more information appearing about what your opponent may have gotten on the first turn, on the second turn, and then finally on the third turn. And that's what you're betting on along the way.
So it's a little bit like Battleship.
It is a little bit. Yeah, you're like saying like E5, essentially. But your opponent doesn't know that you picked E5.
So, Jason, you said you had to create a game that was all skill, no chance. So there's no chance in this. Everything is under the control of the players. But what's the skill? What do you need to do well to win?
What you need to do well to win in this game is to learn to read your opponent's mind. And even if you've never played against them before, you can look at it and say, well, if I was them, what row would be attractive to me? What would I pick if I was them?
But this is online. So you're playing a perfect stranger and you can't even see them.
You can't even see them. And there's no chat. There's no other communication outside of the game, the communication that takes place through the game itself.
So the original point of this game was to exploit this loophole in the law so that you could create an online game that people could gamble real money for. But what's the point for you of the gambling real money? I mean, all the other games online that are really popular, you can gamble and play, but for virtual currency, you know, virtual gold, virtual jewels, or whatever.
Right. And in this game, you can only play for real money, right? So I allow people to play all the way down to a penny, where, like, each player puts a penny into the game and you're fighting over fractions of a penny. Because I found that, you know, when I was playing poker for real money, it kind of brought the drama and the real-life impact of the game to like a very different level than what I was experiencing in games where the consequences weren't real. And I really like games that somehow reach out into the real world and kind of affect the real world in some way.
Well, the other thing is the fact that it's real money, I assume, means that in order to play the game, people have to give you their credit card information.
Right, right.
That's the point at which it feels real.
Yeah. You come to this website, and then you load the game up, and then the first thing it shows you is, here, enter your credit card, and tell me how much, you know, money you want to deposit. You can deposit anywhere from $2, which is the bare minimum, all the way up to $999,000. I mean, assuming that your credit card limit goes that high.
What's the highest stake anybody's played for?
There was a one point in time a couple of months ago where a self-described .com millionaire came into the game. He had played some of my games in the past, and I've actually gotten to know him over the years. It's kind of an interesting story because he started off playing, you know, a $5 game and lost. And then the players he was playing against, who were established and good, were willing to follow him up. He then played a $10 game, and they joined him. And then he lost that and went up to 20, then 50, then 100. He kept losing on purpose. Then he got up to $500 games. And he was like, now I'm playing for real stakes that I care about. I've lured these people up. And then he tried to start playing for real and, of course, still didn't know how to play. So over the course of a couple of days, he lost something like $6,000, mostly to one person, who was this college kid who had like never gambled before and just had put $15 into the game or whatever. And all of a sudden, he's sitting on like $6,000. And he's like, whoa, what happened to me here?
So I want to ask you about the design of the game. So you said it looks a little bit like a bingo board. But I have to say, looking at it, what it actually looks like is a bingo board created by medieval monks, because it's
right.
It's got all these weird arcane symbols on the side. In fact, the entire site, frankly, looks a little sketchy. So why?
Yeah, so when I set out to make this game, I started reading the history of gambling, right? And I found that there's this intimate connection between gambling and fortune-telling and religion and the occult, people rolling the bones to commune with the gods or do fortune-telling and then using the same bones on the weekends to gamble with. And, even if you think about like a modern casino, it's kind of like a giant cathedral. And one of my game designer friends likes to say it's like, this temple where we go to sacrifice a bit of our hard-earned money on the altars of the gods of chaos, right? So anyway, I decided that I wanted to make a game that was both an occult ritual and a gambling game kind of rolled into one. And so that grid of numbers that you see that looks like a bingo card is actually a magic square. This is an ancient numerical device that's part of numerology and magic rituals that goes way back. I mean, you can find magic squares carved into some of the most ancient temples in the world.
Wait, what makes something a magic square?
So a magic square is a grid of numbers, and they're arranged in such a way where each row and each column sums to the same amount, and each diagonal. But if you think about it, I've got six rows, and each row sums to 111. So that is actually where the number 666 comes from, is from the 6x6 magic square. And when I was sitting down with that magic square and just testing it for gameplay purposes, and I added the numbers up in my calculator, and I saw that come up on the screen, I was like, oh my God, I was sitting at my kitchen table, and I just slapped my forehead. I was like, this is it, right?
Jason, the thing that really fascinates me is that going back to this theme of luck versus skill or chance versus skill, I was kind of thinking that maybe that's what makes a game a game, that you've got both some skill and some chance involved, and maybe even in equal amounts.
Right, right. Well, a lot of people in the world of board games and other kinds of games kind of turn their nose up at games of chance, right? Like if you go all the way down in the ladder, you get to a game like Candyland, the children's game, where you turn over a card, it tells you how far to move, and the game just plays itself based on what cards turn over, and you have no choices to make at all. And a lot of people scoff at that.
So is that why that game is so boring?
Yeah, there's absolutely no skill, there's no choices to make. On the other end of the spectrum is a game like chess or a game like Go. The game doesn't play itself at all, and you're sitting there kind of like just, it's raw brain power against raw brain power. Whoever can kind of think deeper into this gigantic tree of possibilities.
So there's no chance. It's all skill. But on the other hand, I'm not sure I'd say it's fun.
I would describe chess as a dry game as a game designer. And it's not something that people play for laughs, really, I guess. So kind of in the middle is this perfect sweet spot, right? And this is the spot where games like poker, games that actually have a huge amount of cultural currency reside, including most sports, right? I mean, sports have this enormous element of skill, right? Like how fast can you pitch a ball? How accurate can you pitch it? But when someone goes to swing at that ball, there's a ton of chaos involved there in terms of exactly where the ball is going to go and how far it's going to go and what angle it's going to fly at and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So these things that really excite us and that create these moments that are sort of once-in-a-lifetime moments. When you play poker and you, every once in a while, every, 200 and so hands, you get dealt two aces in Texas Hold'em. I mean, it really feels like you turn up those little cards on the table, those little pieces of paper, and there's two A's staring back at you. And it feels like, all the universe has swirled around you just for that moment to bless you with this amazing thing.
You just won the cosmic lottery.
Yeah, yeah. And so those kinds of experiences, those, oh my gosh, I can't believe this just happened to me, or, oh my gosh, I can't believe he made that shot in basketball, when there's so much butterfly effect from the moment he like touches the ball to when he releases it out of his hand. Those moments are moments that, sort of go down in history as these legendary things, in part because there's so much chaos.
Do you think of a game as a metaphor for life? Because I was thinking that interplay between randomness, chance, and skill, to a certain extent, that's what life is, right?
Right, right. So yeah, I guess games are these microcosms, like almost like little worlds, right, where the sort of laws of the universe are very well defined and known to us. If you think of a game of, baseball or soccer or American football, there's a sort of beginning and a middle and end. There's this time clock running. There's these other elements, and you're trying to sort of chart your way through it in a way that puts you in a victorious position, where we kind of know what victory even means, right? Get more runs in the opponent team by the end of the ninth inning, right? Uh-huh. Whereas in real life, we kind of know the rules, maybe, but not really. Yeah, and we don't know what the victory condition is.
It's a game, but we don't know what it means to win.
Yeah, like I guess we like to sort of operate in these, people call it, in the game design world, they call it the magic circle, right? Where you step into the circle and everything's very well-defined and there's certain rules of behavior inside that circle. And it's also really interesting how much things count inside that circle, right? I mean, you sit down at a game of poker, and you lose, and your $300 or whatever it is gone, you don't say, hey, man, it was just a game. Can I have my money back? In fact, there's all these great stories from history of how much someone has lost in a poker game and how they stuck to it, right? Like my dad's town growing up, someone lost a house in a poker game. Errol Flynn had an island he was going to build a resort on. He lost it in a poker game, right? I mean, there's...
And people people pay up. They don't say, it was just a game. You can't have my island.
No, come on, man. Oh, it was just a joke. No. We lost it at a game. It's fair and square, and we believe in it. It's like, it is like this kind of law that we will not violate once we've stepped into that circle, right?
Jason Rohrer is one of the top game designers in the world. He's designed first-person shooters, adventure games, and games so conceptual, one is in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. Oh, and also a game made of titanium that's buried somewhere in the Nevada desert and is so futuristic, nobody alive can play it. But what you can play and gamble on for real money is his new game. It's called Cordial Minuet, and if you visit our website, Jason will teach you how to play it at ttbook.org. So now that we've encouraged you to gamble your life away, let's at least help you be successful at it. Steve Paulson sat down to get some advice from Michael Mobison. He's the head of global financial strategies at Credit Suisse and author of the book you're going to need, The Success Equation.
And the simple rule is when there's lots of skill, what happened before is likely to persist into the future. But when there's lots of luck, there's no reason to believe that what's happened before will happen again. And so just having that framework in mind, I think, allows you to better understand the past and the future.
Okay, explain that. If there's lots of skill, it sounds like you're saying the outcomes will be similar in the future. Why would that be the case?
Well, you think about a high skill activity, a very trivial example would be something like a running race. So we know that Usain Bolt is the fastest sprinter in the world. And I suspect, Steve, if we lined up against him and he ran, he would beat us. And if we did it again, he would win again, right? So there'd be enormous amounts of persistence. So take that on one side of the extreme. On the other hand, if you are a lottery winner and you were lucky enough to have done that, the next week you play, the probability of you winning again would be very low, right? So it's basically a random process. So what happened before gives you no indication of what will happen next.
Right. And yet I'm guessing that we tell stories about whether there's luck involved or whether, what happened was because of our skill. And do we sometimes get lost in our narratives about skill and luck?
It's a huge deal. It's fascinating. So a little sidebar, there's fascinating work by Michael Gazzaniga, who's a neuroscientist, on split-brain patients. And the split-brain part's important because it allows them to understand the modules of the brain. But to make a long story short, what they found was in the left hemisphere, we have a module they call the interpreter. And the job of the interpreter is to attach causes to effects that it sees. So no matter what happens, your mind creates a narrative to explain that outcome, and then you file it in your brain. Now, here's the key. The interpreter knows nothing of luck. So typically when you observe good outcomes, you assume some good process was behind that, and you observe bad outcomes, you think something bad happened. And the interpreter doesn't make that distinction. So we are constantly confused by narratives, by stories that explain what's happened, and we don't take into consideration appropriately the role of luck.
Can you give me some examples of this? I mean, what might be some activities that we think are mostly a matter of luck, but actually there's a lot of skill involved?
Usually it doesn't go the other way around is where people get confused, right? They think there's a lot of skill and there's a lot more luck. You know, one example that's a very clear one would be professional sports leagues. So what we're able to do is look at professional sport leagues, and we can actually use some quantitative methods to do this and actually place them on the continuum quite accurately. So, for example, the NBA is a sport that contains the most skill, or skill is the most dominant in that sport, whereas something like ice hockey tends to be most random. And the way we do this quantitatively without getting into the boring details is we say, what would the world look like if only luck mattered, right? So for every sports game, simply you would flip a coin and whoever called it right would win that game. And then we examine from an empirical point of view how far we depart from that scenario. And that range of departure allows us to then estimate the relative contributions of skill and luck. So there's an example, and if you, by the way, just in terms of rank order, it goes NBA, and then it's Premier League Soccer, then Major League Baseball, then the NFL, and then the NHL. The NHL is a sport with the most randomness in it. And I'll mention something else that was sort of it's been the most talked about part of the book. And it's something that I call the paradox of skill. I want to be clear, it's not my idea. But the paradox of skill sets, when you think about skill, you have to think it on two dimensions. The first is absolute skill. And I think if we look around the world today, whether it's investing or business or sports, I think we could generally agree that absolute skill has never been higher. But the second dimension is relative skill, which is the difference between the very best and the average. And what we've seen in these same domains is a collapsing of relative skill. So the difference between the very best and the average is less today than in generations before. So when you think about something like the NHL, as you point out, the scoring dimensions and just the best players are only on the ice a certain percentage of the time and so forth. But there's another way to think about it, which is essentially if the skills are equally matched, then luck is going to determine the outcome.
Yeah.
Right. So it doesn't matter how, if you and I are playing tennis, if we're evenly matched, then luck will be much more important. So it's this sort of paradoxical idea that in many cases, as skill goes up, absolutely, it collapses relatively, and more is being left to luck. And this is a really interesting idea that in the world, more and more is being left to luck, not because people are not skillful, but rather because their skill is becoming more uniform.
You write that the secret to success is the reversion to the mean. Can you explain what that means?
So reversion to the mean is an idea, which is, by the way, very tricky, but it says that outcomes that are far from average will be followed by outcomes with an expected value closer to the average. So that's a mouthful, right? But it basically says something like to always realize whenever you're seeing extreme outcomes and there's luck involved, you should anticipate that the next outcome will be much more close to the average. And it's very difficult for people to do that because as humans, we tend to like to extrapolate things, right? Things will continue as they are forever.
Well, I mean, let's talk about gambling. I mean, it would seem like the obvious case of someone's at the roulette wheel is on a hot streak. Are you saying that you should assume that hot streak is going to end?
Of course. Yeah, and of course. And gambling, there are a lot of things that also the outcomes, if it's assuming everything is fair, these are random outcomes, right? So they're independent and random. So, yeah, there is no such thing as a hot streak, right? So there are people that win in successions or lose in successions. But
what do you mean there's no such thing as a hot streak? I mean, people at the gambling table talk about hot streaks all the time.
Yeah, well, that's all contained within what you would expect from probability theory. For example, as you have 1,000 people and you flip coins 20 times or 30 times, there'll be a statistical distribution where some people will call them all right, some will call them all wrong. We know that a priori just based on the statistics of it. If you happen to be the person calling it right or wrong, you're going to feel like you're on a hot streak or you're really lucky or really skillful. But we know, again, statistically, that's well contained and explained by what we would just expect by randomness.
Okay, what about a hot streak that an athlete is on? You know, an athlete who's in the zone. And I mean, there was a great example this year in the NBA. Klay Thompson goes off in one NBA game, sets the NBA record for points scored in a quarter, 37 points in the third quarter in one game. He's never come close to that before, probably will never do that again. How should we look at that?
There are two ideas here. The first is, and this has been talked about a lot, is the idea of a hot hand. Right. So you're the guy who's hot. We pass you the ball and you keep making shots. Now, the hot hand initially about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, there's a paper that basically debunked it. They looked at NBA data and said, basically, this doesn't exist. So that's one thing.
Wait, how can we say it's not? I mean, we can watch a game and we can see this person has the touch right now. You feed him the ball. He keeps making shot after shot. How could that not be?
So the key point, Steve, is it's within probability. In other words, it's within probability. So the second thing I'll say is that when you see streaks in sports, and this would be, you know, Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak or a player making consecutive field goals in basketball. So basically streaks, those outliers are great skill plus great luck. And if you think about it, that sort of has to be true. So saying this differently, not all skillful players have streaks, but all the streaks are held by skillful players, right? Because skill is the prerequisite and luck comes on top.
So do you kind of look at the world through the lens of probability?
I personally do, and I think that writing this book, by the way, has really made me much more mindful of a lot of these concepts. And I think that, again, going back to this concept of the interpreter, this part of our brain that's creating causes for every effect we see, we naturally are spinning narratives around us to sort of weave together a cohesive world. And when you introduce these ideas about probabilities and luck and skill, I think it gives you a very different take on many situations, hopefully a more refined take on things. And again, the key is to allow you to better understand what has happened, but much more importantly, again, a better way of thinking about what is likely to happen. So just a much richer, I think a much richer way of thinking about what happens in the world.
So I have to ask, do you believe at all in fate or destiny?
No.
Why am I not surprised?
No. It's a probably more complicated answer than that. But no, the answer would be no. And I think this idea of things that are preordained or deterministic, certainly that's not a way of thinking that is attractive to me.
Michael Mobusen is the managing director and head of global financial strategies at Credit Suisse. His book is called The Success Equation. He also created some simple online games as examples of some of the things he and Steve were talking about, and you can play them on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about skill versus luck. You know, most of us spend a lot of our lives trying to acquire more and better skills. But choreographer Bill T. Jones says his mentor, the musician John Cage, spent a lot of his life pursuing luck. Bill says Cage's music is all about randomness and chance.
His world was changing. It was the Cold War. He didn't know if the kind of modernist music that he was in pursuit of was, quote, speaking to the world. He had a long-term marriage to a wonderful woman who was his collaborator, and he was no longer in love with her, but falling in love with Merce Cunningham. There was a lot of insecurity he had until one of his teachers, actually his Eastern teacher, said, John, you don't have to have the answer to everything. And when he realized that, he began to look for means. And one of those means was the I Ching and indeterminacy. How do you make decisions? Toss the I Ching. Why is your opinion or your choice more important than what the sticks tell you or the coins tell you? It was a revelation for him. Do I marry this woman or marry this man or not? Let's toss a coin. No, I don't think I would do that. However, when you're doing something like, you know, there's a sequence of movements to be had, and you're just, that you like them all well enough, but you're not quite sure, well, he says, toss a coin and let the coin tell you. Theme, variation, development, climax, he thought was a big straitjacket. A real, predictable arc. And for art to progress, you had to get rid of that which was predictable in it. If you're really trying to wade out into the water of those that want to lead the discourse, you've got to break all those rules and maybe turn your back on what feels good. In In 1999, we premiered a work in three parts called We Set Out Early, Visibility Was Poor. The second section, Cape Bardo, was performed to a recording of John Cage performing Empty Words at the Teatro Lirico in Milan. The audience of revolutionary students began to riot in response to Cage's reading Walden Pond. Not the text as written, but phonemes or word fragments chosen by chance procedure. Later, over dinner, Stephen Wright, a manager of symphony orchestras, said of both Cage and Schoenberg, "For practically 70 years, conductors and impresarios have been trying to force this stuff on audiences. When will they realize people just don't like it? Audiences simply don't want it. It doesn't work." The concert that I was just reading about there was reported to me by a dear friend of his and mine. That's how I know him, through Betty Freeman, a great supporter of contemporary music. She happened to be there that night in 1978 when the students actually were so shocked that this revolutionary artist they'd been told about was not revolutionary in the political sense, but in aesthetic sense, they literally stormed the stage, drank his water, knocked his glasses off, and he kept going with Empty Words. 2 hours he keeps going with those phonemes, and you hear the audience turn into a roaring wave of oppositional forces, screaming, chanting, until half of them leave and he continues the concert.
Like bells, large, smooth pines.
Artists, and if I dare say, in the same breath with John Cage, we are a perverse bunch. I think people often say, are you just trying to shock people? Well, no, you have an idea that is scary to you. And you think you're going to put that idea up there and see what it does. And you're holding on with, my hands are black. I'm a black man, but I'll say with white knuckles. How is it going to fly? You don't know. And sometimes, even when the answer comes back to you in the form of an audience full of applause, you're still wondering, what did this mean? I think he was a brave pioneer, saying to us, those of you who want to be artists, realize that it is something more like a religious calling than anything else. It is a test of your faith, every new piece that you make. So yeah, do your best work, do your scariest work, but realize you will find there's no succor here. There's no safe harbor here. He is the one that, for some reason, never fails, because he never really promised anything. He never promised anything other than, if you want to know what to do next, do the next thing. What?
Choreographer Bill T. Jones, talking about his mentor and friend, the musician John Cage. Cage died in 1992. But if you want to hear some more of that historic performance, including the riot, we found a 33-minute sample and put it on our website. It's at ttbook.org. In 2004, Annie Duke was in the final of the World Series of Poker. She was up against the top two poker players in the world, Phil Hellmuth and the other one who just happened to be her older brother. The jackpot was $2 million. Now, if you know poker, you know what happened next. Annie won. But that's not the point. It's how she won that's legendary. It was near the end of the game, and Annie drew two sixes. Phil folded. Her older brother then got two sevens. And at that point, Annie's chance of winning was just 18.5%. She told Charles Monroe Kane what happened next.
And then I hit the six, and I had multiple emotions. You know, I was obviously very happy to see the six, but I was obviously also very sad to see the six because I wasn't really rooting against my brother. If I'm going to knock my brother out of the tournament, I don't want it to be on some stupid bad beat that I put on him where, you know, he has the much better hand.
You got lucky, right?
Yeah. It was definitely a lucky moment. I just like people think of luck, like bad luck, as just something bad happened to them and good luck is something good happened to them. I think about it as when you're kind of on the bad end of what your expected value is. So you're setting some sort of expected value. So for example, let's say that we were betting on flipping a coin and I was taking heads and I happened to flip heads 3 times in a row, which is only going to happen 12.5% of the time. In my everyday life, I would say, oh, I got really lucky to have that happen. And you got unlucky to have that happen to you, that you happened to lose that 3 times in a row. But in a more technical sense, you can kind of think about, there's another step, which is you can be very low percentage to win something, but still be making an excellent bet and actually still be making money on the bet. So I could have a hand that's only going to win 20% of the time, which means that for every dollar that I bet, I need to be winning $4 on the times that I won in order to break even. If I bet a dollar where I'm going to win $5 on the time that I win, then I'm making a really good bet. I'm going to win money, but I'm expecting that I'm going to lose that 80% of the time. So when I lose that particular hand, I don't really think of it as bad luck because I'm kind of supposed to lose it 80% of the time. And when I win it, I'm not necessarily thinking good luck because, well, it was just 20%. And I'm thinking more about the investment that I made.
Right.
So I think the difference is that when poker players are thinking about luck, they're adding this extra step, which is what your expected value is. Whereas when you're using it in your everyday life, you don't have that kind of extra step of what was the expected value.
Well, what about everyday life? I mean, you've been dealing with this a long time. I'm sure you've brought this to a little metaphoric value. You're a mom, your wife, you're a world citizen. Do you look at this? Oh, 18.5%.
So I do. And I think that what happens is that poker players are dealing with uncertainty all the time, which is really where luck comes from, right? Like in chess, there's no luck because there's no uncertainty. There isn't this random element where you can't really predict the outcome necessarily and random things happen. If you're going through a traffic intersection and you are following the rules and you only go when it's green, that doesn't mean you're not going to get hit, right? Because it's not a zero variance game. So I think that because I play poker, I don't sort of ruminate and think, you know, sort of get like, oh, I got so unlucky, I can't believe that, and start getting really upset by it. Because I think that I'm taking into account like a certain percentage of the time things aren't going to work out and a certain percentage of the time they are. So I think about it very probabilistically that nothing's 100%.
You know, it makes me think about from another poker player, Phil Hellmuth has this great quote, "If it weren't for luck, I'd win every time."
Well, so I actually now do a lot of consulting and speaking to executives. And in every talk that I give that quote from
really?
Phil Hellmuth, funnily enough.
That's awesome.
Yes, and I have a picture of him with the quote, "If it weren't for luck, I'd win every one." And what I say is the problem with that is that on both sides, it's really bad. It's saying if you took luck out of the equation, then my decision making is perfect. And that's bad for both reasons. If you chalk bad things that happen to you up to bad luck, there's nothing to be learned from it. You're just sort of ruminating on your bad luck, right? And kind of not thinking about, well, what was the learning experience I could have from it? But on the flip side, if you attribute good things that happen to you to skill, which is what we tend to do, so we flip it, right? Like the bad things are, something bad happened to me, I had such bad luck. The good things are, oh, look at what a great decision maker I am. That particular thinking error is one of the most prevalent thinking errors. It has a name. It's actually called the fundamental attribution error. It's very common.
You know, you have a quote on your website that I don't fully understand it. I've been trying to understand it. Tilt usually arises from something you don't have a lot of control over. Can you help me understand the bigger meaning of that one?
Sure. So tilt is a term that poker players use. That means the state of being emotionally out of control because of something that happened that then causes you to make bad decisions going forward.
Do you mind giving an example of that?
Sure.
Okay.
I get all my money in with aces and somebody else has 2-5. So I'm going to win that hand 82% of the time-ish. And I lose the hand and I lose a bunch of my chips. And now I just start playing every bad hand that comes my way.
Right.
Because I'm just so upset that I lost the hand. That's being on tilt. In life, it's like you see people on tilt all the time. It's like they get in a fight with their girlfriend and all of a sudden they're at a bar on their 17th beer. You know, it's like that's going on tilt. So most people, when they lose that hand with the aces, get really emotionally off center and they become very not decision fit. So they make really bad decisions going forward, where a more rational person would say, I had aces, the other person had fives, I had the best hand. Nothing after that was in my control whatsoever. All right, so 18.5% of the time I'm going to lose that. I lost it. Let's move on to the next hand. I can be comfortable knowing I made a really good decision. But that's very hard for people to do because it's that, you know, why did that happen to me? Why was I so unlucky? I made such a good decision and then this horrible thing happened to me. And now they can't really get their frontal lobes engaged anymore. Their temporal lobe is now just taken over and their limbic system is on fire. And they tend to lose all their chips after that. So keeping control really matters. And it's what keeps you in control is the ability to recognize what was in my control and what wasn't. And I'm not going to ruminate about the things that weren't.
That's Annie Duke. She won the 2004 World Series of Poker Championship and the Heads Up Poker Championship in 2010. She now lectures on the science of smart decision-making. Charles Monroe Cain talked with her. And hey, if you want to see that epic 2004 moment when Annie Duke became the world poker champion by drawing that historic six, the video's on our website. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Julie Schumacher, author of Dear Committee Members, and my bookmark recommendation is José Saramago's The Elephant's Journey, written in Portuguese but published in English in 2010. This short novel reimagines an odd historical incident from the 1500s. The King of Portugal offers as a wedding present to his cousin, the Archduke of Austria, an elephant named Solomon, who then, accompanied by appropriate regal fanfare, makes the long voyage, mainly on foot, over the Alps from Lisbon to Vienna. Well, the elephant has a trainer, a mahout from India, and he worries a lot about his relations with the royals who are on the trip, about pleasing them. At one moment, the elephant is asked by a priest to kneel down in front of the church to show that he is a creature of the faith, and the Indian elephant driver needs to make that happen. The pilgrimage of the elephant Solomon and his entourage is strangely fanciful and comic, the point of view shifting from one character to another. In one passage, the elephant Solomon admits feeling anxious about, quote, his grayish coffee color, sprinkled with freckles and hairs. It was a permanent disappointment to him, despite the advice he was always giving to himself about accepting his fate. Saramago's trademark prose style, the phrases and sentences unlatched from one another and curiously recombined in a breathless, semi-punctuated fashion, can take a bit of getting used to. But a few pages into the novel, the effect is wonderfully hypnotic. The narrator darts like a buzzing insect through the paragraphs, reappearing unexpectedly here and there to make pronouncements or to ask questions about grammar, war, God, marriage, class, race, geography, and human-animal relations. Quote, it is time to warn the reader that two of the characters here are not acting in good faith, unquote, the narrator says. In the hands of a lesser writer, such interruptions would be annoying, but in The Elephant's Journey, they are seamlessly woven into the text. I worry that someone listening to this recommendation might decide that The Elephant's Journey sounds difficult, experimental, inaccessible. But Saramago's novel is funny, poignant, and deeply moving. This is not weighty historical fiction. It's a very contemporary and remarkably cheerful flight of fancy. By retelling the wildly improbable story of an elephant traversing the Alps almost 500 years ago, Saramago creates a one-of-a-kind journey for the reader as well. As one of the characters in the novel ultimately concludes in a moment of celebration, it isn't every day that an elephant appears in our lives.
Julie Schumacher recommends The Elephant's Journey by Jose Saramago. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And it's Valentine's Day weekend, and since we've been talking about calculating the odds, let's see what higher math can tell us about love. John and Julie Gottman are two of the most famous marriage researchers in the world. They're famous for being able to predict with 94% accuracy whether a couple will split up, stay together and be unhappy, or stay together and be happy. Sounds like magic, but actually, they told Steve Paulson, it's math.
Remember the old experiment we used to do in high school where we take iron filings and put it on a piece of paper and put a magnet under the paper and we'd see the force field of the magnet?
Yeah,
the
I
magnetic
remember this.
Field.
Sure.
Right. So, well, what we found is that there is actually a vector field, a force field, when two people who love each other are talking to one another. And the math explains it.
Wow. Now, Julie, I know that you've developed these ingenious ways to study relationships. I mean, for instance, you've designed a lab that looks like a B&B, and you bring couples in there, and you watch them. You watch how they interact with each other, which I have to say is kind of daunting to feel like these experts are watching, you know, how good you are at your relationship. What are some of the most important things you've found?
Well, in part we found, and this was very, very subtle, that when a partner makes a bid for connection, just calling out the other partner's name, for example, how does that other partner respond? If they turn towards the other person and respond to their bid for attention, that's very, very important. If they say nothing, that's not good.
You're talking about in very kind of mundane situations. I don't know. I mean, you're sitting down for breakfast. You're both kind of getting ready for work. And one person puts out an offering there. You know, oh, did you see this in the newspaper, something like that? And that conversation can then play out very differently from there on.
Exactly. The apartment lab sat on the Montlake Cut. It was beautiful. So boats would go by. So if one person was looking out the window and said, wow, look at that beautiful boat, and the other person said nothing, we'd call that turning away. If the other person said, that was turning towards, just the smallest response made a tremendous difference in whether or not couples became friends and stayed friends in their relationship over time.
Because basically you're demonstrating whether or not you show interest in your partner.
Yeah, not only that, Steve, but guess what couples mostly argue about?
What?
It's not money, sex, in-laws, drugs. It's really the failure of the bids to connect. That's what couples argue about.
You're saying they basically argue about nothing.
That's right. They argue about nothing. But when you look at the, you know, the details of it, when you do what Malcolm Gladwell calls thin slicing, you see these attempts to really get close that have been ignored or responded to with irritability. And that's what they're fighting about.
Yeah. Huh. So what's a good fight then?
Well, that's a great question. So a good fight, first of all, begins by what we call a softened startup. So John found in his research that the first 3 minutes of a conflict conversation predicts not only how the rest of the conversation will go, but how the rest of the relationship will go. So a softened startup might sound like, you know, I'm a little bit upset. So they describe their own feelings. Then they describe about what. I'm upset that the bills haven't been paid. Then they state what they need to make it better. Would you please pay the bills tonight? A bad fight, in contrast, would begin with what we call a harsh startup, which would sound like, what's the matter with you? Are you too lazy to pay the bills? It's a criticism.
I want to come back to this thing that you said, that you can determine this within the first 3 minutes of a conversation. I mean, you have this amazing number. I mean, apparently, 96% of the time you can predict the outcome of a conversation based on how the first 3 minutes are going to go.
That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. We were as surprised by that as, you know, as anybody else.
Well, you've come up with these phrases. You sort of divided couples into two groups. There are the masters and the disasters.
Right.
What are the basic differences?
Well, Well, you know, we have very low standards for what a master is. So, you know, the couples who more or less like each other over time and stay together, those are the masters. They're putting energy into romance and being kind to each other. The disasters really are constantly scanning their partner's behavior and looking for their partner's mistakes, trying to improve their partner. The masters are much more accepting.
Mm-hmm. Let me add to that. The masters and the disasters both criticize, may get even contemptuous or defensive sometimes, but the masters try to repair quickly.
Explain what you mean by repair.
Well, a repair would be something like, you know, I'm sorry the way I started this conversation. Can I start over again? What I'm trying to say is I really need you to, you know, greet me with affection when I come home. You know, that's what I wanted to say in the first place. And I'm sorry I started off being such a jerk about it. That's a repair. Mm. The most effective repair is taking responsibility even for a part of the problem. So if you say, you know, that's a good point, honey. I mean, you know, I probably was pretty grumpy. You know, tell me more. This is the most powerful repair of all. And it's even more powerful when a woman does it for a guy.
Why is that?
Because men really feel like, you know, they're the ones who are always at fault. You know that old joke, if a man speaks in a forest and there's not a woman to hear him, is he still wrong? So guys always feel like, you know, women are saying all the problem is theirs.
So does this mean that guys are more sensitive to criticism or that women are more prone to offer criticism?
You don't agree with me? I think men are more sensitive to criticism.
No, they're not more sensitive to criticism. I think women are quite sensitive to criticism, too. But I think here's the big difference. Women feel like they are guardians of the relationship. It's up to them to keep the relationship strong. But what that means is that they're bringing up problems that they see in the relationship. The difficulty is that they don't know how to bring up the problem in ways that are more helpful as opposed to critical.
More gentle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. 80% of the time, it's women who bring up the problem. Julie's right.
That's interesting. So if women are the ones who tend to be sort of the caretakers of the relationship, the overseeing the health of the relationship, what's mm-hmm. the guy's role in this?
Well, see, that's a very interesting thing because men play a really critical role. So before our conflict discussion, Bob Levinson and I had couples just talk about how their day went. And the guys who are disinterested, not very positive, they get this harsh startup from their women. So I remember this one guy who said, yeah, why don't you talk about your day? It won't take you very long. So right away, he started with a contemptuous statement, right? Or another guy who, as his wife was talking about something really interesting to her that happened to their two-year-old, he was looking bored, looking at his watch, you know, communicating his boredom. Well, they had harsh startup. So guys are really important in turning toward these bids.
Hmm. I want to come back to this sort of this use of math that you have. I mean, you've come up with a whole series of what you call love equations. And you throw around terms like nonlinear differential equations and emotional velocity and inertia, emotional vector force field. I mean, the kind of stuff that I would expect to read in a physics book, not discussions about love.
Well, I started my career in math and physics, and the numbers allow you to discover patterns that are really invisible to clinicians. For example, Bob Levinson did a study where he took the first 3 minutes of conflict for five couples who eventually divorced and five couples who stayed together. And he had experts try to tell from the first 3 minutes which ones would divorce and which ones would stay together. And nobody was better than chance at doing it. But when you get the numbers, we can discriminate with over 90% accuracy.
What are you, intuition, when you say you get the numbers, what do you mean? What are you adding up?
Well, we're really looking at a whole variety of things. First of all, we're looking at facial expressions, voice patterns and behaviors and the way people look at each other, how they respond to one another. We're actually looking at their heart rate, how fast their blood is flowing, how much they're sweating from the palms of their hands. And we put those in terms of numbers. And the numbers wind up telling us these differences. So we get kind of a real subtle discrimination between what makes a relationship work and what makes it fall apart.
So you have more than 40, what you call principles of love.
Right.
So I hate to ask this, but if there is one takeaway that you can leave us with, you know, one thing that you wish every couple listening to this would sort of go home and try, what would it be?
I think the most important principle is empathy, actually, is to turn towards your partner and listen with empathy. What we have found is that it makes a huge difference. So if John hears me complaining about something in the relationship and he responds in the way that he has lately, which is heaven, by saying, "Honey, what do you need?" I fall over in bliss. I'm so happy. So, you know, it's that kind of response, turning toward and turning toward with empathy, that really makes a difference.
She's really smart.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Marriage researchers John and Julie Gottman with Steve Paulson, who is incidentally my husband. For more about the Gottman's research and their many books, look them up at the Gottman Institute. That's it for this hour, but you can hear more when you subscribe to our podcast. Just look us up on iTunes or Stitcher. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane put this hour together. With help from Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon, our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.